Danny J.
And I'm Jill Coleman.
Welcome to the Best Life Podcast.
Here we talk about everything from success, money, relationships and entrepreneurship, to productivity, honest communication, positive psychology, and how to cultivate an abundance mindset.
Make money, travel the world, deepen your relationships, live full out.
This is the Best Life. All right, we are here with Kara Lowenthal. Yes, Lowenthal. And I'm super excited to have her on the show. She is the author of the upcoming book, Take Back Your Brain, and the Unfuck Your Brain podcast, which when I heard that name, I was like, this is the best podcast name. Like, I'm so jealous of this. Now, did they not let you use the same name for the book, or you didn't want to use the same name?
You could theoretically use it, but they felt that, which I agree, like that title has actually been used in a lot of books. There's like, it's sort of played out. And there was actually a book called Unfuck Your Brain published a while ago. And then after I started it on a totally different topic, it had to do with the brain, but like very different than my podcast. But when I started my podcast and my podcast got more kind of prominent than that book. So then people would send me pictures and be like, someone stole your name for their book. And I was like, no, it's okay. That book's been out for a while. Like, so we didn't want to duplicate, you know, cause even more confusion.
Totally. Well, it's a great name too. And I love just reading a little bit more about what you do. And you're also the founder of the Feminist Self-Help Society. Lots of questions about that. I'm super excited. Just so you know, our audience is mostly women 35 plus. A lot of them are here to learn about how to be authentic, how to show up fully in their relationships, how to show up fully in their life, how to communicate better with their loved ones, and really just, I don't know, step into their best life. This is called the Best Life Podcast. And I always say that we actually did start this in 2017 before like living your best life was like an actual thing. And so, but now there's like a million Best Life podcasts. So we are just so excited you're here and we can't wait to hear more about what you do. So if you wouldn't mind starting, just giving the audience a little bit of backstory in terms of like who you are, how you got here. I know you have a really cool past that has brought you to this place. So we'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, I came from the traveling circus. No,
I mean, Danny kind of did,
you know.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. See, that's that weird coach psychic. Yes, I came through what I call the Ivy League lawyer to life coach pipeline, which is a small pipeline. It's only a few of us. I was a reproductive rights litigator and academic, and I'm sure like a lot of your listeners, I had that experience I think women often have in their, especially once they get into their 30s, of sort of like, okay, I like did all the things I was supposed to do. This is supposed to be my best life, supposedly. I like went to college and maybe I got a graduate degree and I like, you know, live in the city I thought I wanted to live in. And I like, I'm doing these things and I supposedly was going to start feeling better about myself and my life at some point in this process that was supposed to happen, allegedly. And like, that just doesn't seem to be happening. And so I think there's that like moment of reflection for a lot of people of like, wait, what? Like, I did what I was supposed to do. I didn't get, not getting those feelings that, you know, that I thought I was going to get. And for me, because I think it felt especially clear because I had this very traditionally prestigious career. And so if external accomplishments were going to create confidence, you'd think they would have by then. It was like, I went to Yale and then I went to Harvard Law School and then I clerked on a federal appeals court, which is like a very competitive legal job to get. And then on and on, like ending up running a think tank at Columbia Law School. And yet the voice inside my head is still, oh my God, everybody thinks you're stupid. What if they ask you that question? You don't know the answer. Like, you talked for too long in that meeting. Your research isn't good. Whenever anybody reads it, they're going to know you're a fraud. And so at a certain point, I just had to look around and be like, something is wrong here. Like, I am clearly not an imposter. I am, in fact, an expert in my field. And yet, like, this is what my brain is doing. And I realized it wasn't just me. When I was litigating reproductive rights, I was working at an organization that is, you know, the top two organizations doing that in the country. All the women working there are literally the experts in the field. That's what they do. They argue at the Supreme Court about reproductive rights. But like, you're in meetings and people are still prefacing what they say with like, maybe this is a dumb idea, or I don't know if this makes sense. Or so I just, you know, it was clear to me that like external change was not going to solve this problem. I couldn't get like another, you know, it was tempting to be like, well, I'm sure once I get my tenure track job, then I'm totally going to feel smart and like I belong. But I, thank goodness, finally realized that wasn't the case before I like moved to Kansas to teach torts or something. And I had always been into I guess I would call it broadly self-development, but for me, I think that the self-development work that women do is work that like men would call philosophy, but for women, it's like self-help or self-development. It's like the big picture questions of what does it mean to be a person and who am I trying to be and what should my life be like and what am I doing with my limited time on earth? So I'd always been interested in that stuff, you know, just that stuff, and had like gone to therapy, you know, I'd gone to therapy, I'd gotten into yoga, I tried meditation. I like did all the things you do in your 20s and 30s when you're trying to figure that stuff out. And I found this form of coaching, or the sort of basis of the form of coaching that I now do. I found the person who taught and trained me to be a coach, and her work just changed my life. And I wasn't intending to do that professionally. I'd invested a lot of time and energy in this other career, but it was so powerful. And it was like such the missing piece for this like tension I had noticed among myself and all my other accomplished, wonderful, amazing women friends who had terrible thoughts about themselves. And so I, yeah, just as one does, woke up one morning and said, never mind being a law professor, I'm going to become a life coach. And that was 8 years ago. And now I have about 10 employees. I run a multi-million dollar business. I've coached thousands of women. And now my book is coming out. So it's never too late to jump off that traditional path is one message for sure.
Dang. I love that you had this whole traditional path. And also what's interesting to me that you mentioned, I mean, your resume, you know, you're like, oh, Yale, Harvard, Columbia, like that's no big deal. But if someone who's been to those schools, these prestigious places and has this resume and still feels like something's missing, then I think it just validates anyone else who has any other feelings that way. It's like, if that person can feel this way, then we all must have something going on. So you said you worked with this life coach. What was it about the work that you did and maybe the work that you do now with your clients that really helped you see a shift? Was there a certain modality around it? Was it just question-based? Like what were the...
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I had worked with several coaches that were not that helpful before I found my coach. And, you know, coaching like therapy, like anything else, there's like great stuff out there, not as useful stuff. People resonate with different things. Yeah. But a lot of the coaching that was out there, I think the field has become like so much higher caliber now in the past like decade, but especially when I started looking into it, and it still felt more kind of fringe. A lot of it just seemed to assume that sort of you didn't have a brain. It was like, well, you just like set up a reward or a consequence for yourself. And I was like, okay, but I know that I could just not do whatever I'm supposed to do and not give myself the consequence. Like I'm not a doll, you know, like, it was like, it was sort of like the dumbest version of kind of behavioral psychology. And it was I was just like, who does this work for? People who don't know that they don't have to throw the $5 out the window if they smoke a cigarette or like whatever setup you've been told to do. So what I learned from my teacher was a lot of it is sort of based on cognitive behavioral therapy. But I think in a kind of broader framework that doesn't look at just like resolving sort of problem thought patterns, but also kind of growing your vision for what your life can be. And it was really the two things that I learned that completely like stopped the car, blow my mind, were that maybe it was three, but it's that your thoughts aren't necessarily true. It's like, especially as somebody who had built this whole career on my brain and had spent my whole life being told that I had a very specifically, you know, good brain and that my brain was like really smart. You know, I had a lot invested in the idea of being very smart and having a very reliable expert brain. So that was kind of mind blowing. A lot of my thoughts were not true. I didn't have them because they were true. I just had them because I'd been taught them or human brains tend to think that way. So not all my thoughts were true. My thoughts were what were creating my feelings. That was the second premise. So I, of course, like most people assume that my boyfriend, my parents, my boss, the weather, the size of my apartment, what's in my bank account, how my thighs look, whatever. Those things were all causing how I felt. So it's pretty mind-blowing to discover it was what I thought about those things that was causing how I felt. And then the third piece was that if one and two are true, your thoughts aren't necessarily true, and your thoughts are creating your feelings, you can change how you feel and how you act by changing your thoughts. Mm. And that was just like, I mean, I literally remember being like, did everybody else know this? Like, why isn't this kindergarten? Like, why did I learn geometry, which I have never used again. I mean, some people do need geometry, but like I learned a lot of shit that I have never thought about again. And no one told me that like the biggest impact on my life is what I'm thinking and what feelings I'm creating for myself. And those are driving all the actions I'm taking. So that was really what I learned from my coach. And then over the years, what I have added to this work that kind of wasn't in the coaching industry when I got here is the understanding that your family's not the only source of your thoughts. Evolutionary psychology is not the only, like evolution, how your brain evolved is not the only source of your thoughts. There's an enormous influence, especially if you are a woman or another marginalized identity. The huge influence nobody was talking about was, what does society teach you about yourself and about people like you? What messages do you pick up that impact your thoughts? And that's why you end up with most of the men in the positions that I had seemed to feel fine about themselves, but most of the women in those positions doubted themselves all day. That's not because of estrogen. That's because of what society teaches women about themselves. So that is kind of the direction my work has gone since then.
I love it. And I love that now you're doing that work to get that out there even more. Actually, I had a very similar sort of experience with, are you familiar with Byron Katie's work?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she was like, introduced me like about 12 years ago, and it just completely blew my mind. And she was like, don't believe everything you think. And I think, so I'm going to ask you the tough question, which is sometimes, or one of the tough questions, but sometimes do you experience, maybe for you and probably for your clients, when you have that negative feeling of like, I'm not good enough, or you want to beat yourself up, or you want to do the like imposter syndrome comparison thing, or these kind of things that sort of come up, sometimes it can be hard to get out of those and choose something else. Cause in a way it does make you feel kind of safe, or you kind of like, you don't want to give up this feeling of, I don't want to say victimhood or whatever, but you do sometimes just want to have that pity party and be like, yes, life is happening to me and my boss is an asshole and you don't understand what it's like for me. And like, so how do you sort of get people out of that, because that can feel really safe to just, because then you don't have to do anything, right? Because, but if you're telling me, man, you're saying, Jill, you have a say here, and like, you can choose your emotions, you can choose the actions that you take, that's a lot of work. And
I mean, I think it's really, this is going to sound like, well, I don't know what this is going to sound like, but I will say it's just the first part of the answer, but I don't actually ever try to get someone out of that, because it's not my business. Like if you can keep whatever thoughts you want. And I don't believe that. And I don't teach that, like, oh, I know the true objective truth and your thoughts are wrong. Right. It is just, it's all just electrical signals in your brain, and you can keep them if you want. But what I always want women to do, well, everybody, but especially my work is aimed at women, is to be making an informed choice. Like, just understand that you are totally allowed to believe it's an absolute factual circumstance that my boss is an asshole, and I can prove it in any court of law, and it's a universal law. Like, you would totally keep that. I'm not here to take that thought away from you. Even if it's true, though, how do you feel when you think it all the time? People often get stuck in, and I think like coaching that isn't at the level we need it to be, get stuck in like fighting about whether things are true. But I just don't find that useful of a question a lot of the time. Like, for instance, it is true that we're all going to die and we don't know when. But if I walk around thinking all day long, I'm going to die and I don't know when, I'm going to die and I don't know when, for a lot of people, I mean, for some people that might be inspiring. So it's all very individual. Like, sometimes I think I don't know when I'm going to die, and I'm like, great, so I got to really live my life right now. Then I'm getting a positive outcome from that thought. But if what that creates is like anxiety and fear, and I won't eat food out in case it's poisoned, and I won't leave my house in case I get hit by a bus or whatever, then I know that that thought kind of isn't producing the result that I want. But it's always, I think, up to us. Like, sometimes you do need a good pity party. It's just, to me, there's a huge difference between the disempowerment of, my pity party is objectively real, this thing is happening to me, and I can't do anything about how I feel, versus I'm choosing to have this pity party. If I ever want to, I can change how I think and feel. Like, even that shift alone is really powerful. I mean, I don't have a study to prove this, like, next point, but my experience in coaching so many people, and I think that partially because of the like reality-based paradigm I use, I get people really bringing like, you know, serious issues. Like, I'm being harassed. What do I do about that? Like, I, you know, it's not like love and light all the time. The most disempowering thing is just the belief that you have no control over even your own experience.
Yeah.
To me, coaching is so transformative and powerful because it is what allows us to decide our own response and internal experience, even when we are in an external experience that we can't control. Mm. Right. There's some like really toxic spiritual teaching out there that's like, you know, you manifest everything that happens to you. So it's like, if you have cancer, you gave yourself cancer, which is just like,
yeah. We talk about this all the time. We hate it.
Yeah. Completely in bananas. I do not believe that. Obviously that's why I'm mocking it right now, but there are many circumstances in life that we can't control, like other people, what happens to our bodies a lot of the time, politics, we can influence, but not control, like climate change, each of us can, there's a lot of shit going on we can't control. But what we can control is how we like show up to that experience, or even how we talk to ourselves when we are not showing up well in the experience. Like there's always more layers of like, mm-hmm. how do you decide to think and feel about something you can't control? And to me, that's why coaching is the most powerful. Like it's fun to use it to create your dream life, but it's most powerful when you're using it to cope with what is decidedly not your dream life.
Mm. Yeah. You said something earlier, and I definitely want to talk about this given the fact that your sort of tagline for your book is how a sexist society gets in your head and how to get it out, which I love. Mm-hmm. And then you run, of course, the Feminist Self-Help Society. And I definitely want to talk about this because you mentioned earlier how you feel like women more than men as a generalization tend to default to some of these, you know, these negative motivators or beating mm-hmm. ourselves up or always second guessing ourselves. And so can you speak a little bit to when you mentioned sort of the culture or society or whatever we're learning, why is that so different for men?
Yeah. So we pick up on the sort of social messages about people, right? In a million different ways. So you're born and you really don't know anything. You have like some basic instincts, you know, you want a nurse. That's about it. And then as you grow up, your brain is constantly absorbing information. Like you ever watch a baby and they're just like, they look stoned all the time because there's like so much happening, right? Their neurons are connecting so fast. They're learning everything. Mm-hmm. And socialization, which is like the process by which you learn from society, everything, you know, a lot of it's useful. Like that's the reason we don't pee in each other's living rooms is like, we've been socialized to know that that's not what you're supposed to do. And you got to wear pants when you go outside. A lot of it's useful, but we're also absorbing a lot of subconscious information about who's reliable, who should be in charge of things, mm-hmm. who's good at math and science and money, who mm-hmm. takes care of children or should be doing the cooking, who is sexual or not sexual and why, who do we assume to be authoritative, who is wrong if a man and woman have an argument, who's at fault, who is sane and who's crazy in our society? How do we define that, right? So you're picking up all of that stuff. And a lot of messages were not that long ago, historically, quite explicit. Like 200 years ago, it would have just been very explicit for someone to say to you, well, of course women can't vote. You're so emotional and irrational and you can't understand world events. And also sometimes your uterus goes wandering around your body and that makes you act really weird. And it's your natural, I mean, this sounds insane, but this would have been completely commonplace and taught to you at school if you were allowed to go to school, which probably you weren't. Mm-hmm. So that's not a long time, socially speaking. Like 200 years seems a long time if you think about how people didn't have the internet or automobiles. But when you think about thousands of years of society influencing how human culture operates, it's like turning a tanker ship. Like we haven't turned all the way. And so all of these belief systems, most of us now don't hear that outright. Nobody said to me like, well, you can't vote. That's going to give you a headache. Right. Don't think about that. But we're still picking up from like, who's the CEO of the bank in all the movies?
Yeah.
Who is working in all your friends' families and who's staying at home or who seems to get to make the decisions or who seems to be doing most of the housework or whose hormonal cycle do we make jokes about? How many times do we hear the, like, you can't have a woman president. What if she has PMS and she has access to the nuclear button? Like, so we absorb all of that stuff and women are generally socialized to try to be perfect. So there are all mm-hmm. these social standards for how women are supposed to be in every role in their lives. Like, what is your body supposed to look like? Who are you supposed to be as like a sexual object? Who are you supposed to be as a partner? Who are you supposed to be as a mom, which should be mandatory because you need to be one. Who are you supposed to be as a spouse, which again should be mandatory because you're supposed to be one. Who are you supposed to be at work? All of it, as a mother, as a sister, as a wife, as a daughter, as a friend. And women are socialized to believe that anything that goes well in their life was probably an accident, someone being nice to them just being lucky, or maybe they worked really, really hard. But anything that goes wrong in their life is definitely their fault because they made a mistake. And so all of that socialization leaves you with a brain that second guesses yourself all the time, that is always criticizing you. And a lot of women think they're not perfectionists because they think a perfectionist would be perfect. So they're like, no, I'm not a perfectionist. My dining room table's a mess. And I'm like, yeah, that's not how we define it. You're a perfectionist if when you look at your dining room table, you think about how it should be clean and, oh my God, you're so lazy and overwhelmed and like your house is a mess and you really should get, like, if you think that you should be perfect, or you just think, a lot of women will say, oh, I don't think I should be perfect. And then I'll be like, great, what are you allowed to be imperfect at? And they're like, I mean, I'll get back to you. Like, if you are yeah. So you may not use the word perfect in your mind, but if you have a running commentary in your brain about how you should be better, you should be different, you're never quite good enough, it's never enough, you're always not quite there, that's being a perfectionist. And that's how society teaches women to think.
I can relate to all of that. I'm like, yes, ex-perfectionist. But I'm actually really curious about you in particular and how you got interested in this. Like, when you, first off, if you abided by the societal, like, norm, yeah, you probably wouldn't have gone to college and become a lawyer because that tends to be a more male dominated field, right? And then you went into women's reproductive rights, which you're really seeming like someone who's just holding the flag for women, wanting rights for women. And then you talk about the feminist movement and you share a lot of things with women and want to empower women. So where did that come from? Was this a little girl thing? Did something just get, were you a tomboy and like, fuck these kids?
No, I didn't even want to wear pants till I was like 8 years old. I refused to wear pants.
Yeah. I want to hear a little more of how you got this behind you.
I mean, I do think that I was a feminist early on, and in Take Back Your Brain, which is my book that's coming out, I talk about the idea that, like, when I say feminist, and I'm talking about the sort of importance of feminism, it doesn't mean agreeing with every single thing that, like, the modern American feminist movement has ever done. People have a lot of different reasons to agree or disagree with different parts of the feminist movement. It's left out women of color a lot of the time in America. It's made, you know, I don't agree with all the decisions. I'm talking about feminism as a philosophy, and I really think there's only really three options. Either you think people should all have the same rights and opportunities regardless of gender, or you think men are better and should have more, or you think women are better and should have more, which we don't even take seriously as a position in our society. It's really only one of the other two, which just like shows you where we are. And there's more than two genders, obviously, but the way that society teaches us these things, it's, you know, the two. So I was always a little feminist, but I think for me, that was part of what drove this work, is that I was like, I had this split brain experience that I think a lot of women have, whether they call themselves feminist or not, which is like, I know I should feel empowered, but like, I don't, right? I don't, like, I would have this experience where part of my brain understood that, like, somebody I went on two dates with who ghosted me was probably not a major player in my life or the person that my self-esteem should be based on. I intellectually understood that. And I didn't even have the value of, like, I should be married by 25. So on a logical level, it made no sense that I would be like fixated on like what happened and why, what did I do wrong? And are they going to text me? Right? Like, a lot of women, it may not be dating for them. It might be like, your job, whatever. But so many women can identify with, I call this in the book, I talk about this as the brain gap. It's like this gap between how you think you want to feel or what you think you believe, and then like what you actually secretly worry might be true or think or feel.
Yeah.
Right. And so I had that. So I had all these feminist ideals, and I wasn't raised in a family that was focused on marriage particularly. Like, I come from a kind of high achieving, high educated New York Jewish family. It was like, of course you're going to get a graduate degree and then you can think about it. Like, there was certainly the expectation that I should get married and have Jewish babies eventually, but it was not like, that's the most important thing in life. Who cares about, you know, it was very education accomplishment focused. I was always taught, you know, I could accomplish anything I wanted to in my professional life, but still I'm over here on Tinder, like, obsessing about why somebody, what's the percentage of swipes and whatever. So that gap really was actually a lot of what led me to this work of being like, this, what is happening? And now from this vantage point, having coached so many women and done this work myself, I understand that what's happening is really, we talk about it like, I think this, but I feel this. Like, a lot of women have said that, you know, I think this, but I feel this, but I really feel. It's actually that you have two thought patterns, and one of them was like imprinted in your brain when you were very young. And that's the one that's like, a woman has to be married or there's something wrong with her. How you look is the most important thing about you. Everyone needs to like you or you're not safe. Like those, that's in the primitive brain associated with survival. And then, yeah, when you're 20, you get to college and you like learn, you know, you come up with a new thought about how maybe you don't have to be married to be valuable. But like, if you haven't done the work to change your thinking on purpose, you're just layering one thought on top of this other one. And they're just gonna be in conflict the rest of your life. You can mm-hmm. resolve that and like rewire your brain to believe what you really want to believe. And that's what I teach in the book and on my podcast, but you have to do it consciously. Otherwise they just both live in there going like, it's like ping pong back and forth in your brain.
In some yeah. ways, I love your description of the brain gap, because I feel like I've had that so many times where mm-hmm. I'm like, logically, I know I shouldn't feel bad or I shouldn't think this way, right. but I do. Do you think the brain gap is kind of a consequence of self-awareness? Like if you don't have any self-awareness, you'll never have a brain gap because you don't think you should be doing anything mm-hmm. else. Like,
if yeah, you're just maybe. Ignorant, I mean, no if you, brain gap. If you live in like a super fundamentalist community, maybe where like yeah. everybody's just like, yes, you are a sex object who should just have babies. And you're like, yes, I am. That all makes sense. Then like, yeah, maybe yeah. you don't have that gap. But
yeah.
I think most women living in like the mainstream now have that gap, because it is sort of a, you know, it's an indication of like where we are as a society. But even yeah. when the social beliefs were more explicit, there was still that gap, right? There's always been people in any marginalized community who are like, wait a minute, I can read though. And I yeah. think that I could, I think I should be able to vote, right? I think... I don't think my uterus is wandering around my body. That doesn't sound right. Like,
yeah, yeah.
There have always been, you know, so, and I think even and in more fundamentalist communities today, I'm sure there are women who are going through their lives just being like, something about this doesn't seem right, but I just can't put my finger on it.
Totally.
It's so
totally.
Interesting to me. Danny and I talk about this quite a bit on the podcast, where we're seeing a lot of, especially like bigger podcasters, male podcasters, talking about how the population is declining because a lot of women now are working and they're making their own money and they're being more educated and some of the stuff. And I know it's not probably meant to come off this yeah. way, but for us, it comes off sort of accusatory, right? Because, you know,
right. How about like the population's declining because you guys aren't willing to stop doing whatever you've been doing and like make this shit more equal? Maybe
right.
It's
and also like be more attractive. So we actually want to.
Right. Like, or like take paternity leave or demand that it be given or do your share of the household work or
right like or make
a million
it easier.
Other things you could do to right. make right and to make yeah. like that seem more appealing to people.
Take care of the children that you made.
Right. Totally.
That's exactly it. Because, you know, we now, like if we're talking about sort of traditional, you know, masculine feminine roles within a relationship, Danny and I talk about this quite a bit. I don't know if you know anything about The Best Life, but Danny and I both went through infidelity with our marriages. Mm. And then we kind of came together and to talk about it, and we're both divorced now. And so we kind of talked about the feeling of like, God, I'm so glad that mm-hmm. I didn't depend on my husband for financial, you know, cause that's the complaint. Like, you know, women just want to make their own money and they got to be like the boss babe and whatever. And I'm like, dude,
well,
we got to.
Women right. want to have economic equality. What's wrong with this picture?
We want to yeah. do something that we love and that fires us up. And we don't want to just like sit at home and wait for the babies to come out. Like we, you know, we have like dreams and goals and stuff yeah. like that. And we can make an impact as well. And so we're like, so it is kind of a catch-22 for women, because we can't rely necessarily on the men. Like we maybe were used to being able to do maybe, you know, generations ago. You know, like, so both of us kind of looked at each other and we said, wow, we're so glad, because I know a lot of women can't get out of a marriage because they don't have any financial resources. So it is, but then there's this sort of accusatory feeling of like, you know, these women don't want to have any more kids or what. I'm sure it's not supposed to come off that way, but that is. So what's your take on that? Have you seen some of that, like more sort of like traditional family values, sort of, I feel like coming back up a little bit?
Oh, I mean, I think
mainstream.
There's a huge,
we have like Jordan Petersons and like people like that who.
Well, there's like a whole trad wife resurgence on Instagram, which is like,
huge
people married to the you know, like people married to billionaires being like, look at my chickens.
Yes,
this is true.
Yes,
and it's very, I mean, that aesthetic is not actually what most women in traditional marriages are experiencing, right? It's right. not, the women are all white, they're all thin, they all have enough economic privilege to be able to stay home and bake sourdough bread and like only have a reasonable, manageable number of children because they still have access to birth control. And, you know, it's like, it's this very unrealistic picture of what traditional gender norms used to lead to, which was mm-hmm. women having more children than they wanted, marital rape, not having any control over their own reproduction. Women of color have always had to work outside the home and not been afforded that like sphere of domesticity due to economic oppression. Like, it's just it's a fantasy. Like, it's not what, you know, I don't see a lot of people who truly grew up poor, like rushing to that trad wife aesthetic, right? It's like,
yeah,
it's wealthy women cosplaying, wealthy white women cosplaying. And, but I think it's attractive because, I mean, number one, I think those sorts of things are always attractive when things feel unstable. So I just think mm-hmm. part of it is like where right. we just are outside political, of gender stuff yeah. in our society. Yeah, it's like this presidential year, the wars that are going on, the climate. It's just like things feel unstable. The 24/7 news media, like people just feel destabilized, and they like it's very attractive to sort of fantasize that you could just like make sourdough bread all day and that would be your life and you wouldn't have to kind of engage with the world. So I think that like that is the reason that appeals in some way. And I do think that, you know, this is sort of when I was talking about like society doesn't change that fast. It's like the tanker doesn't, you know, there's sort of like still generations of men who maybe saw with their fathers or their grandfathers a certain way of relating or a way of having romantic relationships that they sort of grew up believing that they would have that also, which is like, you take care of everything and I do what I want as long as I bring home the check and nobody asks me any questions about that. And they aren't kind of adapted to how things are, right? I mean, I keep seeing this tweet go around that's like one person saying like, why did like our grandparents' marriages last so much longer than ours? And some woman was like, because women couldn't open checking accounts.
Right.
On the other side though, but like but what feminism or at least a more just equal analysis offers us is there's like, I think there's a stereotype that like feminists want everybody to have to work. Like my partner is retired and I work because and he's a cis man. And you know, in our relationship, that's actually how our personalities align better. He mm-hmm. is like very nurturing. He loves to take care of other people. I would like to be taken care of in those ways. Like his love language is running errands or doing little things during the day or like taking care of the kids or handling the household. Like he likes that stuff. Now, and he's perfectly smart and had a whole career before I met him and we, you know, and he retired and this is how we do it now. And those are not my strengths and that's not what I want to do. And so like a relationship can still, if the people in it want, have a balance of like caretaking or household management or your sort of compensated professional labor or whatever else. It's just the point of feminism is that we shouldn't pick that based on like your genitalia and what gender society said you were, you know. And some people don't want that. Some people both want to stay home if they can. I don't know how you'd make that work in today's economy, but maybe some people both want to be high powered, you know, they want to be like two C-suite executives and like nobody cleans the house, I guess, or they hire someone to do it. But the point is just for like everybody to have all the options and be able to arrange themselves in ways that make sense for them. But I think the thing that scares me about the trad wife aesthetic is the idea that, you know, it's sort of romantic or there's no repercussions to relying on men financially. And the truth is like, even when you swap the roles, there's some risk in my partner relying on me financially. Statistically, it's not the same.
Yeah.
Because he's a straight white man. And so his employment opportunities, if he decides to go back to work, would be very different than if the roles were reversed.
Yeah. We have a really interesting society too, in that we've got these people talking about how women should be staying home and not working. But really, I think what it is about, it's just having the choice, right? Like our grandparents, like you said, they couldn't open a checking account, but it's like, maybe a woman wants to stay home and be with her kids and her husband has that availability to do that and afford that however they do in this society. But it's the fact that she gets the choice today versus before it wasn't a choice.
But also she should be informed, like have a
prenup. Yes.
Like if you're going to go into that, as opposed to thinking like, this is romantic to just give up my career and not make any legal provision for myself.
Yeah,
of course, like negotiate that if you want. But the irony of this is like, if you accept the feminist premise, which is that women's uncompensated work in the home is economically productive labor, then you are negotiating from a different perspective of, okay, it's not that I'm not working and you're working. I am working inside that. I mean, this is the irony of like traditionalists saying that feminists like don't respect women's work in the home or like don't think it's important. I'm like, we're the ones who think that it should be respected more.
Yeah.
Right. Is that it's economic labor and it should be compensated accordingly. So like, it's like going into a business partnership, you know, there's, first of all, you always have a prenup. I wish more women understood this. And if you don't, because if you don't make your own, then your prenup is whatever the state has decided your prenup is. There's always a set of laws that govern what happened if your marriage ends. So you get to pick it yourself, or you get off the rack, one size fits all from like the state of Tennessee or whatever. And it's probably not going to be as good for you. So yes, like, of course, if you want to stay home, by all means, but please have a conversation, have a legal document that outlines like what happens if that doesn't work out, that recognizes that all of your labor in the home is an economic contribution to the unit, and understand the history. Not to be all like, I see tweets, especially since I don't even have a Twitter or X account. I think they just come through Instagram.
Yeah.
I just read the story from a woman where I was like, oh my God, yes. Where this woman said that she like took her fiance to meet her grandma, and you know, they had like a lovely lunch, and her grandma was like, oh, congratulations. You know, so happy for the wedding. And then they went home, and then the next day her grandmother called her and said, make sure you open a bank account that your husband doesn't know about, and you put money in there every month. It's like, that's what women of that generation knew.
Yeah.
Because they knew what happened. So it's like this sort of collective amnesia about what marriage used to be like and still is like a lot of the time is a problem.
Yeah. It's so,
and I say this as somebody engaged to get married, lest anyone listen to this and be like, she must be a bitter hag who doesn't like, I am performing a very heteronormative cosplay myself, like marrying a straight white dude who has children with an engagement ring and a wedding and everything. But best believe we have a prenup.
Well, that's what I was going to say too, because I think they're like, is that we sort of like have this conversation about women, sort of women's rights, and it can come off very like unromantic, like you're saying, having a prenup, like a lot of women, I see, it's like, oh, it's not romantic, or you're already thinking we're going to get divorced. And I think I speak for Danny and I, both of us, I think probably went into our marriages. I mean, I probably would have had a prenup, but like we both went in thinking like, this is it. You know, I think everyone goes into their marriage going, this is it. Now on the other side of that, I have a different view, and it's hard because you sort of do walk this line of like, I don't want to be bitter and I don't want to be cynical, but like you do have a feeling of like, you got to still take care of yourself. And you do, when we look at people who are like so blissfully happy and stuff, and I'm super happy for them, but I'm also like, but it's also insurance. The divorce.
I mean, that's like saying like, it's like saying it's unromantic to have in medical insurance. That's like believing I'll get sick, which I do think there are probably some nonsense manifesting people who think that, but
don't put it in the universe.
A prenup is insurance. I mean, take it out of romantic. What if your spouse develops some sort of brain tumor that gives them an entirely different personality, and they quit their job and decide to spend all their money at the racetrack?
Yeah.
Now what happens? Like, it doesn't even, it's not just even about, like, it's not assuming that you'll fall out of love or your love isn't real. It's like, so much shit can happen. What if they get lost at sea and you have to have them declared dead? Like, what? Anything can happen. If you've been to law school, you've read a lot of weird fact patterns about what happens, the weird shit that happens in people's lives, and then they don't have a plan in place. So think of it that way, if that helps you. It's like not really about your relationship. It's just about, statistically, this could go one of a number of ways. Let's make sure that we have planned for all of them.
Yeah. I think you're speaking our mind.
Yeah. And I like how you mentioned a prenup. In my mind, I'm thinking, okay, a man and a woman come together. The man has the job, the woman doesn't. The prenup protects him from giving her everything. And you're like, no, the prenup is saying, if this doesn't work out, like, I'm still making sure that I'm taken care of if it doesn't work out. And so that's really, really important that both, a prenup is for both sides to be protected. Yeah.
That's what my prenup is. My prenup is so that my partner, who isn't currently, you know, I mean, he does some work still, but is not having a full-blown career the way he used to. And I am, and I make the money in our relationship. It's to protect him, not me.
Yeah, really. That's really good, I think, for a lot of people to hear. I want to talk a little bit more about unfucking our brains.
Yes.
So you were talking about emotions and how we don't have to believe our thoughts, which I really love this. I actually read this book last year called Feeling Good. It's a really like CBT based cognitive behavioral therapy based book, and really shifted my beliefs around depression, anxiety, mental illness, and all of that. And I think it was really helpful for me. But I know you have something, the three R's that you talk about in your book. Mm-hmm. Can you share with those about these emotions and how we start to process, and like, how do we, if we feel an emotion and not, how do we not blame our thoughts? So walk us through those steps.
So in the book, I talk about, yes, the three R's of emotions. And, you know, I'm obviously a very like cognitive focused person. So I get a lot of people who are like that are drawn to my work. And then it's not a bait and switch, but it's a little bit like, just kidding. You have to learn about your emotions anyway, because your emotions are like the compass in your body that tells you what your thoughts are going to produce for you. So when we have an emotion come up, most of us think that what we're experiencing is our emotion. So if we're like, I feel upset, I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel guilty. But actually what we're experiencing is probably 20% emotion and 80% reaction to the emotion. Right? Because what happens is we start to feel a little anxious, and then we start thinking, oh my God, why am I anxious? What do I have to change? I don't want to feel anxious. I can't feel this. Oh my God, something's wrong. Right. And we really overreact to the emotion we're having. American society has taught us that like, we're all supposed to be happy all the time. It's like positive, good vibes only, which is like the worst slogan in the entire world. It's literally not possible. You'd have to be a robot. So we respond to like a normal part of human life, which is having some quote unquote negative emotions. I don't even love that term, but I use it because people know what that means. Like feeling anxious, feeling sad, feeling guilty, feeling afraid, whatever. Emotions that our body's like, oh, I don't like that. We really react to them. We all of a sudden start having thoughts about them. And then we do one of, I think, our three options, which is we resist them. So that's what we do, where we are like, I am just going to ignore this. How can I distract myself? Can I get on social media? Can I drink? Can I take some drugs? Can I watch Netflix? Can I, like, what can I do to just like shove it down and ignore it? Right. And I think actually men are socialized to do this the most. And like, definitely when I met my partner, I had to do, we did a lot of like, he had just been like shoving them down for decades. Yeah. Right. So, and that leads us to become completely alienated from our own emotional experience and disconnected from our bodies. We don't know what's happening. We just like kind of disassociate from our own emotions, or we try to drown them with other kinds of stimulation, basically. So that's resisting our emotion. Then we can react to our emotion, which is when we sort of like, we know it's there, and then we are freaking out about it. And then we are like, okay, I have to get rid of this. Like, I think people who tend to react tend to be more impulsive in terms of like, what can I do to get rid of this? Like, if I'm anxious about someone not texting me back, maybe I'll text them again and see if I can get a text. Or if I feel sad, I'm going to like, these people will often, when they first learn about coaching, try to kind of jump to like a toxic positivity of like, okay, I'll just change all my thoughts and then I won't have to have any of these negative emotions ever again. Like, that's not really any more helpful than trying to ignore them when you are like overreacting to them, because you're still just trying to get rid of them. You're still just sort of like being triggered by them and trying to act your way out of them. And the third, which I recommend, and this is what I try to teach, is that we can receive the emotion. And I like the word receive, because people are always hearing to feel your feelings. And it's like, well, people don't know what that means. And even just thinking about the idea, like even if you imagine your physical posture, when you have an emotion, if an emotion's coming at you, what are you usually trying to do? Like if you are a kind of resistor, then you're either usually trying to like push it off or like turn around so it can't find you or something. Mm-hmm. And if you are a reactor, you're probably more trying to like, oh my God, I'm gonna catch it, or I'm gonna put it in my pocket, I'm gonna like get around it, like I'm gonna do something to make it go away. And receiving is really this posture of being like open-armed to the emotion of like, I am just gonna let this emotion like land in me without trying to shove it down or drown it out or get away from it. And in the book, I walk through like a couple of different techniques for actually doing that. But even just that mental shift from when an emotion comes up, my unconscious belief is I need to get rid of this as fast as possible, which is how most of us live. Even just changing that to consciously thinking, the next time an emotion comes up, I'm going to try to really like allow it to be there in my body and see what happens. Just that will change everything. And you will find that like 60-80% of what you used to identify as feeling bad was actually your reaction to the emotion. The emotion itself is just a sensation in your body. It is the like, oh my God, this can't be here, I have to get rid of it, that is so distressing. Because if you think about it, when you tell yourself that a feeling in your body is like a dangerous problem you need to get rid of, you're activating your sympathetic nervous system. You're basically telling your brain that there's like a lion in the house, except the problem is it's inside your body and you can't get away from it. And so you just spiral up and get more and more agitated because now your brain is like, oh my God, something dangerous is happening and it's inside my body and I can't get away from it. And then it just all spirals. So a lot of the times we don't even have to solve a problem if we're just, or a feeling, if we're just willing to like not react to it, it ends up not being that big a deal and it passes a lot more quickly.
I love that so much because as you were talking, I was just thinking, you know, especially for Danny and I, and I think a lot of our listeners, we probably fall into the reactive, like by nature, we'd probably fall into that second category because we just want to do something, right? We're like, I want to leave the marriage or I'm going to go to couples. Like we just need to fix it. You know, like we're just like, we have this feeling of like, and so I found at least when Danny and I were both kind of going through our divorces, we both found ourselves being like, I need to leave. I need to file. I need to like, it just, you want to do something to feel like things are moving. What my practice became, and I think Danny's as well, was being able to just sit in the discomfort of not actually knowing yet what is the best choice or where you're going to go or whatever. And I think so many of us have a hard time just sort of sitting in that feeling of, I don't know. And like, but, and I'm sure you're probably in your experience with your clients, at some point they do know, you know, like at some point.
Yeah. And human brains hate uncertainty. And I'm also a reactor because I think a lot of perfectionist women are because we want to control everything to feel safe.
Right.
So if we have a negative emotion, it's totally fine. We're just going to project manage that away. We're just going to like talk to this person, then talk to that person and make sure they do this and they do that. And then, and like, it gives an illusion of control and effectiveness in some cases, but there are going to be things in life you can't project manage away, like a divorce or like someone you love is going to die. And okay, maybe you can project manage the hospice, but like you can't project manage your way out of like,
gotta read all the books,
finality and like, of death. Like that stuff's going to come up. And you, I think, for me, my practice is also very like, why don't I just wait 24 hours and then see if I still need to like do a thing about this, right? That's sort of like that perfectionism really, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, work out there about perfectionism as a means to control. It's a way of trying to control everything and feel safe in that control, which I think is true. And I think it's important for women to understand the reason you're like that isn't because you have a personality failing. It's because you've literally been taught by society that anything bad that ever happens to you or anyone you know or around you is your fault. So how are you not getting, right? I mean, you just think about like anything's wrong with your kid, it's the mother's fault. Every sexual assault trial, it's like, were you asking for it? What were you wearing? Right. He said, she's right. I mean, women are just taught from a very young age that if anything goes wrong, it's their fault. So of course you're going to end up with perfectionistic thought patterns and trying to control everything because you're just trying to feel safe.
Gosh, yes, that's definitely it. I'm really curious, and thank you for elaborating on that. I'm really curious if you've had much pushback. Obviously you have a huge platform, you have a massively successful podcast, the book is coming out soon. Have you gotten pushback? I'm sure you've gotten pushback from men, but I'm wondering about how much pushback you've gotten from women about your messaging, because feminism is a pretty like triggering word, right? People have feelings about it. And can you speak to a little bit of this? Like we hear the term internalized misogyny quite a bit. Like, do you get pushback from women? Yeah. I mean, you can answer about men as well, but I just sort of,
I mean, I'm sure that a lot more of that is coming with the book, because at this point, at least with a podcast, it's like people have to be looking for it. They find it. I think that, so I'm sure that I will get more. I do think though, like a lot of what feminism unfairly, I think, gets criticized for is like being very like, you should be this way. And so much of my work is like, I'm not telling you how to be. I don't, my end dream goal is not a world in which every woman is empowered to have all the beliefs I have and make the same choices I do, right? It is really like, I want women to be empowered to live the lives they want, but that does mean for all of us questioning our beliefs and our norms. So like, why do I think this is important? Why do I believe this? Do I want to keep that? What are my values? How did I get here? So, but I have had to, for me, it's been more about like, I have to grapple with the fact that like, I don't know, what if I'm empowering the next Phyllis Schlafly who's going to successfully get our right to vote taken away? Like, I don't know. That could be happening, I guess. But I really believe that when people have internalized, like people internalize socialization that goes against their own interests when they don't have something else to base their self-confidence on, It's that question of like, why do people mm-hmm. vote against their own interests? Or why mm-hmm. do I think mm-hmm. that like, if you've been rewarded by a social structure and you've been taught that your worth comes from complying with it, it feels mm. threatening to hear that things could or should be another way, which is why mm-hmm. to me, all of this work is like, what is a woman's relationship with herself? How does she talk to herself? Where does she think her worth and value comes from? I think that if women all believed that their worth and value just came from existing the way men are taught, we would have a very different looking kind of political, social, whatever spectrum. But women are taught that their value is like the stock market. It like goes up and down based on what everybody thinks about them at any
given moment. Let's not even talk about aging in our society.
Yeah. I mean, we could have a whole other podcast episode about that. Like, so I think that to me is like the core of it. I don't really read feedback from men. I just don't really. I don't. I mean, they don't really. Occasionally I get women weirdly writing to me and being like, can you do like a version of your podcast that's for men so my boyfriend will listen to it? And I'm just like, no, that's not. And when I occasionally get stuff from men, I just say like, first of all, you're already obviously listening, so it's fine. And, you know, women have spent thousands of years learning from materials created for men. So
yeah.
You want to be part of the revolution, you can listen to a podcast that has a pink cover. It no longer has a pink cover, so now that's not even an issue. But
yeah,
I think the pushback I actually get more, as almost any person of size will tell you, the thing people, maybe this has helped me, people who are triggered by me are so fixated on my body size.
Mm.
That like that's where it all goes for whatever reason. It's like that is just so outrageous to them that a fat woman could be confident and happy is like very and not just about her. It's almost like, well, okay, if you're gonna be a body positivity influence, what do you how
but
dare
that's
you
the
just,
only
like,
way, right?
Be living your life just doing other things and talking about other things.
Yeah.
So I occasionally get that, and I did get tagged in a weird series of Instagram stories last week about how my body size was indicative of my demonic obsession. And my alcoholism, which I thought was fascinating because I don't drink at all. But maybe that's because, I don't know. The demonic possession thing, I'm not totally clear on how that works. But it's very, so I get some of that, you know.
Oh,
so
man.
interesting projections. Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the body size thing too, because we women are put in so many boxes. There's just too many things for us to even be able to manage, right? Like you need to be a mom, you need to be a wife. Also, you need to be a certain size and you have to have your hair and face a certain way and you have to be a certain age and you're only allowed to have this age range this big. Yeah. So once you're older,
just die already. Well, I mean, yeah, existing after 40 is like, what's the point?
Right. Even? Like why?
And women go through so many body fluctuation changes, regardless of whether or not you started small or big. We have hormonal changes. I mean, every single woman I know has multiple size clothes in her closet, whether they've had pregnancies or not, just through life and our hormones. And, you know, God forbid you have a baby and you're not the same size you were as soon as the baby pops out. So I saw something. We talk about body positivity. Well, we don't talk about body positivity, but we've had this kind of conversation around the body positivity movement. And I've kind of shared that there's these like self-love gurus and people like, you just need to love yourself. And I've often shared that you have to get this to this level of self, I call it self-myth. Like you don't, sometimes you can't go from self-hate to self-love. Like I don't even think you ever can.
Yeah, body neutrality.
So yeah, so I know your term is body neutrality. I was like, yes, this is exactly what I'm talking about.
I like self-met also, honestly. That's a good one too.
It's just like, you're like, okay, I hear, I'm in a body. I'm not attached to this. So how do you think people reach body neutrality? Because Jill and I actually came from the fitness industry. Most of our listeners have found us through there. So a lot of them maybe have issues with body image, or at least just through exercise and food obsession and those kind of things that they've struggled with. Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of them still struggle with body self-acceptance, no matter the size. And I think it doesn't matter if you are, you know, stick thin or you're very large. I think we still have issues with body acceptance and body neutrality. So share a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think
that.
You can have your own issues with yourself regardless.
Yeah.
The way that sort of people of size are treated in society is different, of course, right? And like, if any of you listening watched yourselves start to think differently the minute that I disclosed I was in a fat body when you didn't know that before, just like notice that. Because for sure, but when I was like deep in diet culture and hadn't done my body image work, I very distinctly remember going to see a famous meditation teacher speak, and she was a fat woman. And my like body image diseased brain was like, well, I mean, she can't really be meditating and like enlightened if she's fat also. I mean, because clearly if you were meditating all the time, you had reached that level of spiritual advancement, you'd also be in a thin body. Like, it is nonsense, but 100% people listening to this podcast have thought that. I used to think that, maybe one of you, like, that is not an outrageous claim in our, in like today's society, that that's the case. Even though it would be insane to be like, well, if you were really enlightened, you'd be 6 feet tall, not 5'5".
Right.
Same
right.
Like,
nobody would say that.
Yeah.
So I love body mat. And I think, honestly, philosophically, from the feminist point of view, I do think there's a very strong argument for being like, we don't have to feel positive about our bodies. Why do we have to think? We don't need to think about our bodies at all. Mm. Like, women are not defined by their bodies, and you don't need to spend a lot of time feeling like, why should you have to feel beautiful? The reason that,
like,
do men
think about their bodies?
Don't give a shit.
Of course not. No, totally. No. So right. I 100% support and believe that. I also think that most humans do care about, like, a lot of humans have like an aesthetic sense. They use style as self-expression. We are, used to looking at other humans a lot. Mm-hmm. So especially in this day and age, I just think for a lot of people, like, if I'm preaching sort of, who cares that you even have a body? You don't need to think about it. It's like too far for a lot of people. Like,
sure.
And I don't personally feel that way. I think I like totally embrace that when people do feel that way. I personally have gotten a lot of joy and satisfaction in my life out of changing my thoughts from like body negative to body positive. But I totally agree that that should not be, I mean, part of like what I love and hate about being a coach and self-development is like, because women have perfectionistic brains, they learn about self-development and then they immediately make that like another thing that they're supposed to be doing perfectly and they're failing at. So it's like, I know I'm supposed to be body positive, but like, I just can't, you know, and then they're like beating themselves up about that, which is like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I talk a lot. I have a whole chapter in the book and I talk a lot of my work about what I call this tool I call the thought ladder, which is a technique that really teaches you how to change your thoughts little bit by little bit. Because the idea that you can go from, you know, my stomach is disgusting to like, I'm a beautiful goddess is in a night is ridiculous. And that's why a lot of people, I think, have unfortunately like tried quote unquote positive thinking or affirmations or whatever, and it hasn't worked and they've kind of given up on it because they're trying to believe something too far. If you know, I can say any sentence in my mind, I can say like, my office will soon be occupied by a dinosaur. Like, I can say that, but there's no change in my body. Remember, we talked about like the body GPS. Like, I don't get any emotional payoff from that because I don't believe it. And that's what people are doing when they try to believe, like, they hate their body and they're trying to believe it's beautiful. It's like saying there's a dinosaur in my office. Like, okay, you can think the thought, but nothing's happening in your body. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, something like, this is a human stomach might give you 10% relief. I always say we're going for like the 10% less shitty thought. Like, that's the goal. We're not trying to feel amazing right away. Usually, especially when you're beginning, the thought you should be practicing would not look good on like a Pinterest background. It's not inspirational. You wouldn't put it on a beach poster. It's like, some people also have stomachs like this, but they are worthy of existing. It's like not amazing. So this is a technique you can learn to scaffold your thoughts little bit by little bit. And then eventually you can get to something very positive if you want, or you can get to body meh and be like, great, done. Now I want to work on my career. Like, there's no should to it. But I think the technique of learning how to shift that little bit, and that's why you have to be willing to be in your body and feel your emotions. Like, that's the irony, is people want to change their thoughts. They don't have to have their negative feelings. But the only way to successfully change your thoughts is to be in touch enough with your feelings to know when you found something that makes them a little bit better so you can keep practicing. So you really can't, the only way out is through, as the Buddhists say. Like, you really have to go through the body to get there.
It's so good. And what you're describing, and you haven't used this word yet this entire interview, I'm wondering how you feel about it, because what you're talking about is like mindset work, right? We see this all the time.
I'm okay,
it's like,
with the
it's
word,
yeah, okay. So it's like, some people hate it, some people love it, right?
I don't know.
But what I really think is interesting is every time you've kind of shared one of these more like thought paradigm shifts, you've always brought it back to like some kind of practice. So in that way, mindset works kind of actions. Like, isn't it? It's kind of an action.
Yeah.
Too.
I mean, mindset gets used, right? It's like, if you look at what Instagram thinks mindset work is, it is like, does not bear a lot of resemblance.
Yeah, it's Pollyanna, right?
To what I teach. Yeah. But no, I talk about the feminist mindset revolution. This is like, you know, in the book, once I go through, like the first half of the book is about your brain, how your brain works, some of the stuff we've been talking about, like, where did your thoughts even come from? How did they get in there? Why are you experiencing this brain gap? All of that. And then the next five chapters are like deep dives. There's self-confidence and validation and body image and money mindset and sex and relationships and time management. And then the last chapter is about like how this work kind of connects to the bigger world, sort of, right? And so I think that mindset, that term, does have this sort of like, you sort of out of touchness, like, is what people associate with it, kind of. Yeah, or it's just like sitting and manifesting. And as you say, like, I think the feminist mindset revolution that I want to see is that we are spending time not just on the structural policy things we need, like maternity care and Equal Pay Act and, you know, all this stuff, but that we are also helping women change the way society's impacted their brains. Mm-hmm. And so it is very active. Like, any revolution is like active. It has to be, something is changing and happening. And so, yeah, I have no problem with the term mindset. That's funny. I often do use it. So I'm not allergic to it in any way. I'm allergic to good vibes only and high yeah. vibrations. Those are the things I'm allergic to. But mindset, I welcome. I do call this feminist mindset work.
I do end the show with good vibes. No, just kidding.
Oh, God damn it.
I'm just kidding.
They're like, this episode's going in the trash. This is a good no, but podcast.
What I do really appreciate about everything you've shared, and I do want to hear more about the book and we'll wrap up and all that stuff, yes. Is that this has felt like a very grounded conversation though. You know, like sometimes if we talk mindset or whatever, it can get very sort of esoteric and sometimes hard to follow and whatever. And this has felt very grounding. I think everyone can follow this conversation and this seems really doable. And so it's not, I mean, it's not a coincidence that you're successful at helping people, obviously. But yeah, could you give us a little bit more info about the book,
yeah.
when it's going to be dropping? And then also we are going to be sharing this during your pre-order period. So yes. We'd love to hear a little bit
the
more about what's going on with that.
For everybody. But yes, I appreciate that. And I do want people, this is like, I want people to know that self-coaching and thought work and mindset work, all this stuff can be super concrete and self-actuating. Like, you are not going to, I promise there's no chapter about like how quantum entanglement means all things are happening at once. So you're already a gazillionaire or like whatever is out there. Like, fine, let's worry about that. Once your thought process isn't why I'm a piece of shit all day, every day, like then we can yeah. worry about quantum entanglement. So the book is called, I have so many feelings about
so
it's just like you can't go from like Harvard educated litigator to life coach without like having a lot of thoughts about the sort of fringe of the yes. life coaching community.
Yeah.
So yes, the book, and I mean, I wrote the book that I, this is like such a cliche, I didn't realize till I wrote a book, but it's true that I wrote the book that I would have wanted to read, because I came into learning about coaching as somebody who was like very skeptical about a lot of the like highfalutin blah 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 nonsense. Like, mm-hmm. I, you know, law school trains you to be a very analytical, logical, grounded thinker. And so I had like a lot of questions. I mean, the fact that I'm good friends with my teacher now and she did not murder me during our coach training when I was like, but what about genocide on like day two? And she's like, ma'am, I'm like trying to teach a bunch of ladies who want to be life coaches. Like, what is happening with you? Why are you in here talking about the Holocaust? But like, that's how I think. I was like, okay, you told me this principle. Now I'm going to take it all the way through. Like, is yeah. it true in every area? And can I really? Okay. Yep. No, it's true everywhere, but I got to test it out. And so I think the book is what I really wanted and didn't really exist at that time, which is like a really like accessible, but rigorous way of going through this, of like really building the argument. Like, this is how your brain works. This is what's happening now. This is how you can change it. Here's what you need to do. And a book that took that social context into account, because when I came into the coaching world, that really wasn't part of the conversation. And so I just kept seeing like myself, my friends, my clients, you know, have women coming to me being like, you know, okay, I understand that like people pleasing is a trauma response for some people, but like I had a perfectly nice childhood and nobody in my family ever made me feel unsafe. And yet I am like paralyzed by saying I'm not going to go to my third cousin's bridal shower because I don't want my great aunt, who I've seen twice in my life, to be mad at me. I must be losing my mind. But all of that was explained when you bring in how society teaches women to think in general. So the book really is like the one-stop shop for, you know, everything that is otherwise in 350 episodes of my podcast. As you know, when you have a podcast, it's like a geological survey. It's like there's things are layered over time, things change, you come up with new ideas. You know, the book is like start to finish, one-stop shop. It's all new stuff because they don't give you publishing contracts for just writing down what you already said on your podcast. And it really will take you from like, I know nothing about this, to by the end of the book, I understand how to change the way I'm thinking to change how I feel and act. We didn't even get into like all the behavior change you want, all of you fitness people, all of you like coming from that world, all those behavior changes you want start in your brain and how you're thinking about yourself. And then what kind of life you can create. So you can get the book at takebackyourbrainbook.com. And the week that this comes out, we are doing, we have a bunch of amazing pre-order bonuses, like a 30-day guided journal to help you start looking at your brain before the book comes out. There's a book club, but also this week. So if you pre-order the week you're hearing this podcast, the calendar week, we are giving away with pre-order of any size, one book or more, a workbook all about perfectionism. So if you've been listening to this and you're like, oh, I thought I wasn't a perfectionist, but now I realize that I am, right? Or you recognize some of these thoughts that we've all been sharing, like, oh yeah, I have those thoughts. I do think about myself that way. The perfectionism workbook is a couple of coaching exercises that really walk you through figuring out what are your unconscious, not just beliefs about yourself, but like your unconscious standards for yourself. Like all of these sort of subconscious or unconscious measuring sticks we use for ourselves that we are then like beating ourselves up with all the time. It'll walk you through uncovering those and help you start to shift those thoughts. And all of those bonuses are like immediate download. So even though you're pre-ordering the book, you won't get the book for a few weeks, you can get started on that mindset work right away. So it's takebackyourbrainbook.com.
That's so generous of you. Are you doing an Audible version also?
There will be an audio version, but if you want those pre-orders, that's, you got to pre-order the hard copy version now. Yeah.
Love it. And y'all listening too, pre-ordering books are so important for the author to get on lists, and we want to make you a bestseller. And, you know, it's so important to get those books out. So if it sounds like something you would love, order one for yourself and maybe order one for a friend too and give it as a gift. I love getting books as gifts, and I always love giving books as gifts too. And it sounds like a book I really want to dig into, and I think has so much. I mean, just this conversation has been really valuable, and those bonuses are very generous and have to be worth more than the book itself. So it'd be worth doing in the pre-order for sure.
It was a good reason to name it something else, because I think people have sometimes felt like, well, I can't recommend your podcast because it's like I'm telling someone they need to unfuck their brain if I send it to them. But you can totally give someone a book called Take Back Your Brain, and it is not going to imply that there's anything wrong with their brain.
Such a good point. And also, you know, with podcasts, and I know we love when people share podcast episodes, but sometimes, you know, if you haven't, you're like, you need to listen to everything.
But like, this will make sense in the context of the other 349 episodes I've done.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe it's a good starting point for them.
Absolutely.
To join the podcast.
That's what it was written for. Yeah.
I love that.
Love it. Well, Cara, thank you so much for your time. And then I guess just where can people find you on social as well? The website. But if they want to connect with you there, where's the best place?
Honestly, my last name is long and hard to spell. So if you just go to takebackyourbrainbook.com, you'll find my whole name. And then you can find me on social media. It's at Cara Lowenthal, but like, I promise the way you try to spell it will be wrong. So just go to the book site. You'll see my name. And then we have links to my social media on the book site also.
And then we'll put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, thank you so much for being here. This was very enlightening. I know I'll speak for Danny and I, we definitely learned something today, and just, I'm sure the listeners did as well. So thank you so much for your time and just for your generosity with all of your amazing tools and insights. And it was just great. So you're the best. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Got it.
Thank you.